thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.
Welcome to the Memories of a Moonbird podcast, exploring life one story at a time. Hello, friends. I'm Daniel Sherrill. Today on the show, this is so cool because when it comes to the need for speed, he's the real deal. As a fighter jet pilot for the United States Navy for nearly 25 years, he flew the F/A-18 Hornet and Super Hornet and the F-16. He accrued almost 4,000 flight hours over 700 carrier landings and served as both a Top Gun instructor and air wing operations officer. Today, this family man flies for one of the major airlines and hosts his own awesome podcast called, appropriately, the Fighter Pilot Podcast. There, he explores the fascinating world of air combat, the aircraft, the weapon systems, and most importantly, the people. And you should absolutely subscribe. I'm so excited to chat with this amazing man and fellow podcast host about all things jets, life in the skies, what it feels like to be in control of something moving 1,200 miles an hour, and what his experiences around the globe have taught him about life back here on Earth. Please welcome Vincent Aiello. Vincent, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I think I should pay you after that. Wow.
So first question, let's jump back to Earth for a minute. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in the Los Angeles area and spent my first 9 years there and then raised up on the Central Coast near Pismo Beach and went back to Southern California for college. And everybody's kind of moved away, so I don't really call it home anymore. I guess I'm a man without a home, but that's where I was born and spent my childhood.
That's cool. And what was little Vincent like as a child?
Oh, he was the younger of two older brothers and an older sister. And my mother says I always used to do what they told me to do kind of thing. So I think the military was probably a good spot for me.
And so you were a good kid?
I think so. Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I had my moments. I'm sure most kids do, but yeah, I think so.
When you look back on your life today, is there some trait that you still have that you think is distinctly Southern California?
Well, you introduced my podcast when you introduced me. Thanks very much. And we recently hit our 100th episode and I asked everybody for what their favorite episodes were and their favorite guests and all that. And then I let them take a stab at me. I said, what are your favorite or worst isms of mine? And a bunch of folks did say my California isms. So apparently I took a page from Bill and Ted and I say excellent and awesome and all those adjectives a lot.
Rad.
And exclamations. Yeah. And so I guess it's just me.
That's funny. So when and how did you become interested in aviation?
Well, my mother and father divorced when I was very young and my mother ended up marrying another gentleman who had a very technological interest. And so his father was an Army major. And so he was raised around the military and he wanted to go to air shows because he loved the technology. He told me later, he really thought the AIM-9 Sidewinder display was the most fascinating thing ever because he remembers the guy held up a cigarette lighter and the little missile on display there would track it back and forth. And my stepdad thought that was the most amazing thing. Well, meanwhile, while he's looking at the technology, my mouth is agape looking up at all the aircraft and the sound and the, you know, the swagger of the pilots. And so I became enamored with the whole idea of being a military pilot at a young age. And for me, that set it in motion.
That's incredible. I think air shows are amazing, by the way, and I'd love to give props to them because they're such wonderful things for people to go and experience. There's nothing like feeling it in your chest, you know, when these aircraft go by. It's a very different experience than seeing it on television.
You know, Daniel, I think we could spend almost our entire scheduled time here together talking about that because not only do you experience it, which is so impactful for people, but it's also the opportunity for young people to maybe have a spark lit. And there's always this, oh, it's a waste of money, or oh, why do we have this or that? and the noise. But, you know, I read a lot of military books, and I've had a lot of folks on my show, and a lot of them did get their start from an air show like I did. And so I think it's a worthy cause to attract young men and women who want to serve in that capacity.
Well, for the listeners, because I think many people don't know and are interested, as I am, to hear, what is the Reader's Digest kind of summary version of how somebody goes from just enlisting in the Navy to then sitting in a cockpit of their fighter jet? How long is that journey?
Yeah, well, if you don't mind me commenting on semantics, Daniel, I will tell you, when you enlist in the Navy, think of that as the folks that go straight from high school into the Navy, and they have the more, got to choose my words carefully, but the basic jobs, you know, you could almost say the menial jobs, but I certainly don't mean to impugn their honor. These people serve, but it's a different category than officers. Officers are the college graduates, and pilots in the military, with the exception of the Army, are all officers. And so you have to start with a degree, and it's a 4-year bachelor's. It doesn't necessarily have to be in something technical, but they all prefer it. You can also go to one of the service academies, the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And so you have to become an officer first. And that, just terminology wise, is different than enlisting. So forgive me for the...
No, that's really good to know, actually.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, now, to be fair, some people do enlist in the military and then become officers and go on to be fighter pilots. So it is important to distinguish that. At any rate, I will give you my experience, since that's the one I lived. So once I decided this was what I wanted to do for a living, and why not try it instead of just wishing and dreaming about it, my stepdad helped me put in an application for the Naval Academy, which was denied. And so I said, all right, well, what else can I do? And you can either go to college on your own and then go to officer candidate school in the Navy, or officer training school, I think it is, OTS for the Air Force. And in my case, I said, well, I'm going to need some help getting through college, so why don't I put in for ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps, which is a leftover from, I believe, World War II. But the idea is you go to a civilian college. While you're there, you play soldier or airman or sailor for a day or two with uniforms, and you take the appropriate courses. And when you graduate from college, you're also commissioned into either the Navy, Marine Corps, or the Air Force. And so that's your first step. Then you go to flight school, and then you go to the different parts of it. And then maybe later, after a couple of years of flight school, you end up in a fighter jet. So from high school graduate, of course, it's 4 years. Once you're a college graduate, it's about maybe 2 years before you first get in. Well, not before you first get in, but before you're, you know, flying a frontline fighter, let's say.
So 6 years, that's incredible.
Yeah.
So when you get into a fighter jet and you're an officer and you're a trained pilot, are you assigned a specific aircraft, or do you guys share aircraft?
Well, sort of both, right? So when you're done with flight school and you earn your wings, then you are assigned a particular type of aircraft. So in my case, it was the FA-18 Hornet. And so I went to training in El Toro, Southern California. The base is now closed. It's near Irvine. And I learned to fly the FA-18 A, B, C, and D. And those are just 4 different models that are very similar. Okay. And so when I then got to my first squadron in Florida, then we had 12, I think it was, aircraft that were all roughly the same. And we shared those, but it was one type of aircraft.
So in the movies, when you see the call sign on the aircraft, do you guys swap those out, and do you actually have the call sign on the plane, or no?
No. So what you do is you have a squadron's worth of aircraft, and you usually have more pilots than there are aircraft. So the front runners, if you will, the commanding officer and the executive officer and a few others will have their names on both sides. But the lower rank you get, the less likely you are to have your name on there, because there's just not enough spots. Or you might have your name on one side and another pilot might have his name on the other. And let's say that happens to be number 406 was mine for a little while. Well, on any given day, you fly whatever aircraft is ready based on the operational schedule and what maintenance has for you. And so it's not always 406. It could be 401 or 410. And in Hollywood, I think they realize very quickly that they'll confuse people if you see, you know, Lieutenant Vincent Aiello flying in a jet that has Lieutenant somebody else's name. So they keep it simple and put them in the in the jets with their names on them. Now, the more I read, though, about earlier fighter pilots, the more I recognize that there was a time when there was an aircraft and a crew chief, as they called it, or a plane captain, as we would call it in the Navy, who was assigned to that particular pilot. So the pilot and the aircraft and the crew chief were all matched and you didn't switch. But these days you fly whatever's ready.
I know this is a very broad question, but is there something about training to be a pilot that most people don't know that you wish they did?
Well, I think what surprises people who want to do it, if I may take that question in that direction, is especially in the Navy and the Marine Corps, is how good of a swimmer and how comfortable in the water you need to be. And that makes sense, of course, because we fly around aircraft carriers surrounded by water. And so if we eject, we could very well end up in the water. Or if we are in a helicopter and we ditch, we might end up in the water. And so I was fortunate that I played water polo in high school, so the water never bothered me. In fact, you know, I was used to someone physically trying to drown me, let alone passive gear that was just heavy on me trying to drown me. And so I never had any trouble, but there were many people who struggled with, you put all that gear on and they dump you in the water and they have different contraptions and devices to drag you around as if your parachute was dragging you over the water, or they put you in this diabolical big metal container that's supposed to be like a helicopter and they strap you in. Sometimes they'll even put darkened out visors or a swim goggles on you, and they'll dunk you in the water, turn you upside down. And when the motion stops, you're supposed to count to two or three and then unstrap and find your way out. And so that really gets some people who aren't ready for that.
Yeah, that would be crazy.
It is. And then you have to do it every so many years afterwards.
Wow. So like recertifying for anything. That's crazy.
That's right.
What was the most difficult part of training for you personally?
Oh, I struggled a little bit when I was flying the T2 Buckeye with my landings, because in the Navy, we always treat every landing as if you're at the carrier. So you have the correct attitude on the aircraft, you're at the correct spot in space, and then you come down the glide slope and you look at the very same lights at a field runway that you may see later when you go to the carrier. And I had a time where I wasn't particularly good at that. And so I got a refly, a do-over, if you will. The other thing I would say is it just comes very fast. So just when you're starting to get the hang of one thing, man, you're on to the next thing. And it's, you know, like the proverbial taking a drink from a fire hose. They don't sit around and wait for you to master it. You're on to the next thing quickly.
Well, let's talk about G's or G-force for a minute. Yeah. For those who don't know, listening to the show, I'm going to give you the dictionary definition here. G-force is a measure of acceleration. 1G is what we generally feel from the force of gravity keeping our feet on the ground. Mm-hmm. The average person can handle about 5 G's, which you can hit on a really good roller coaster. But pilots can pull up to 9 G's, I believe is correct. Can you describe the sensation of pulling these larger G-forces, and do you have to wear a G-suit to do so?
Well, just to put a finer point on how many G's we can pull, most aircraft are designed to go to about 9 because they figure that is the peak G pilots can sustain. I've had guests on my podcast that have talked about pulling 10. I think there was an F-15 that even pulled 14. And when you are in the heat of the moment, if it's either that or you hit the ground, I think your body's going to do what it needs to do. But yeah, doing that on a routine basis is going to be pretty tough. When I went to the centrifuge in South Texas, I even took a picture, but I won't share it with you because it's kind of disturbing. But a lot of the blood vessels in my derriere burst. And so my rear end was purple because of all the blood that was forced down into the seat that was, into my bottom that was planted firmly on the seat.
Wow.
And so to answer your question, yes, you do wear a G-suit. And that helps squeeze the blood from your torso and your legs back up into your brain where it's needed. And it's one of these things, like, I don't know what else, driving a car, if you ever got car sick as a kid, but then you build a tolerance. I don't know, maybe if you drink alcohol when you're first new at it, you drink one beer and you got a buzz, but later on you can have a couple and it doesn't bother you. You build a tolerance and you get to the point where it's more of a nuisance than anything. But it's something where they do train you repeatedly in how to stay in front of it, because it can kill people. And I'm glad to say that there's technology that's starting to come around where if the aircraft senses that the pilot has not made any control inputs after some very high G's, then it will recover if it's going towards the ground. And that's a good thing, because a lot of people do pass out and impact the ground, which is tragic.
Have you ever blacked out or thrown up from G-forces?
I was airsick at first in training, and I got over that relatively quickly, although even towards the end, I could still get a little queasy at times, depending on what I was doing, believe it or not, even with 3,800 flat hours. I don't remember ever completely passing out. So just to, again, put a fine point on this, you have the G-induced loss of consciousness, G-lock, and then you have the A-lock, which is the almost loss of consciousness. And I had that quite frequently. One of the clues or cues they teach you to watch out for is as you pull a lot of G's, you begin getting tunnel vision. So your vision begins to come in from the sides and narrowed down, kind of like Luke Skywalker as he was about ready to bomb the Death Star. You remember that little thing he was looking at?
Yeah.
It comes in from the sides. Your vision does that in gray. And I would get to the point, Daniel, I know this sounds crazy, but I would get to the point where my left eye would go gray and my right eye just had this small opening left. And I used to call it my Terminator, like targeting eyeball. I could just ease the pull just ever so slightly and keep it. So I just had this soda straw vision. And if I did it right, I could move my head around and use just that one little cue there to keep track of what was happening and try to make sure I was in the dogfight still. But yeah, it's crazy what the human body can do.
That's amazing. So do you get on a roller coaster and think to yourself, oh, this is child's play?
Oh, I love roller coasters. You know why? Because you're not in control.
Oh.
See? So when you're in control, that's fun. And don't get me wrong, I do love that. But when you're on a roller coaster, you're at the whims of the roller coaster. And the best experience I've ever had, Daniel, with a roller coaster is we went to Silver Dollar City in Missouri. You probably know about this place, right?
Oh, I know it well.
Yeah. They've got that massive wooden roller coaster, right? I forget the name of it, but it's like, I think got the steepest drop of any wooden roller coaster. Well, we went one year after I'd been there years before. And I expected that it was going to do something because I thought it was a different roller coaster, but it ended up doing something totally unexpected. And it was the biggest thrill I've ever had because it was the surprise of it. So yeah, when you're not in control, there's something fun about that. And yeah, I still love roller coasters. Plus I have boys. So, you know, when we go, that's what we do all day long. And my poor wife can do about two or three and she's done.
Well, this may sound like a silly question, but how hard is it to steer and fly a jet? I mean, how does it compare to, like, you know, driving a car or some other vehicle?
Well, a car, so there are three axes, right, in flying, and it's hard to do this on an audio-only format, but, you know, imagine you have a car. When you steer the car left and right, that is the yaw, effectively, and I'm probably messing up the terms, but you get the idea here. I guess that's what lateral direction. But anyway, so when you go left and right in a car with a steering wheel, that is with the steering wheel, but in an airplane, that's actually with your feet. Huh. And you only do that on the ground or on the flight deck of the aircraft carrier. So you actually steer an aircraft with your feet. Airliners have a little tiller that they use, but in a fighter, it's with your feet. But you don't generally do that in flight. What you do in flight is you instead either roll or you pitch, right? So imagine your car driving down the road. You can steer it left and right. But imagine all of a sudden it began rolling left and right. And you see this sometimes in awful accidents. Well, that is roll. But then also if you were to go off a jump and the nose goes up, that's pitch. And so in an aircraft, what you do is you roll, let's say, to the left in angle of bank, and then you pull back on the stick. And that is how you turn to the left, not just by yawing to the left like you do in a car. So
and this is like
different
when it turns and...
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who's watched an air show or seen an airplane on Top Gun or, you know, Behind Enemy Lines or one of these movies, you see what I'm talking about. Hard to describe, but easy to understand. And so you learn that very early on in your flight training. If you don't grasp that, then, you know, they're going to have problems with you right away. But it's funny because when my kids, I don't know what kind of computer you use, but I use a Mac with a big trackpad, and I move my two fingers towards me, like pulling back, if you will, to make it go up. And one of my kids is the opposite of that. And I always get on him just for fun. I'm like, oh, come on, you're never going to be a pilot. You don't go forward to go up. You pull back to go up. And so I think that's just one of those pilot things. And it makes sense.
So walk us through a typical day as a pilot when you're in active duty.
Well, I mean, first off, Daniel, there's no such thing as a typical day. I mean, if I am in the Navy, as again, with my experiences, that's what I'll share with you. And we were shore-based and we were just, let's say, we'd been home from deployment for a couple months and we weren't even thinking about working up for a couple months. You might roll in at 8 or 9 in the morning, take care of some admin business. You know, you might... go over to the weapons school and see what's new over there. You might have some meetings. Oh, yay, we get to fly. You go do some training for a couple hours. You come back, you debrief it, you wrap it up, and hopefully you're home by dinner. Totally different story a couple months before that when you were on the aircraft carrier, because guess what? You're trapped on the carrier. So you wake up, you're on a ship, you put your uniform on. If you're lucky, you can squeeze in a quick workout or go do something, but you go to the wardroom where they are going to serve you whatever it is they've decided to serve you. So appetites don't matter. You get what you get. And then if you're lucky, you get to fly once, maybe twice, because it's an escape from the fun jail of the carrier. But when you're not flying, you might be planning a mission. You might be talking to the maintenance department or the young sailors and Marines who maintain your aircraft for you. You might go and talk to some of the ship folks for different things. So there's always something that you're doing. And guess what? You're never off duty. Unless the ship pulls in a port where you can have some liberty for a little while. So that's nice. You can't go out to the bar because there are none on American carriers or Navy ships in general at the end of the night. Again, if you can get a workout, that's great. If you've got some friends and you can go watch a movie or blow off some steam playing some games or something, that's great. But otherwise, you're pretty much working full time. And so it just depends on where you are and what you're doing. If you're in training, then you're preparing missions. If you're over off potentially enemy territory, then you're thinking about potential real world missions.
Generally, when something comes in where you have to fly a combat mission, an actual, or you're over enemy territory or whatnot, mm-hmm. I know there are surprises, but in general, is this a pre-planned thing that they say, hey, tomorrow we're going to run this thing? Or is it like emergency, get in your plane, you know?
Well, there's both. Right. So we have different alert status measures. And the idea is, depending on the potential threat, we might have people as well, we might have airborne, right? So if we think there's an imminent attack on us, we're going to have aircraft airborne to defend the carrier and the strike group. If we think probably nothing's going to happen, but it could, and it's an enemy that we're not too sure about how wily they're going to get, well, we might have aircraft that are cocked and ready on the deck, but they're not running. There's just pilots sitting in them, and they could go in as little as 5 or 7 minutes. Then you might have an aircraft that's ready, but the guys down in, guys or gals, of course, down in the ready room, but they have their flight gear on, so they can be upstairs and ready to go. That's called Alert 15, and I once launched from that in as little as 7 minutes. I ran upstairs, jumped in, strapped in, started up, took off, and it only took me 7 minutes. So we can get going pretty quickly.
Wow.
And I've even sat in the jets for, you know, hours at a time, and you hope they'll launch you, and then they never do. And so you get out, and the next guy takes over, and sure enough, they launch him, and you just, you know, get mad. At any rate, and then you could have alert 30 or 60 or 120, and those are just minutes. And that's just, hey, look, we've got an aircraft with some bombs or weapons on it, but we don't expect anything to happen. But hey, this is the modern world. So if they need to upgrade someone from alert 60 to 30 or 15, well, then whoever's on that alert, get ready to go put your gear on and be ready just in case.
Well, I'm curious, what's the most difficult maneuver that you've done in a fighter jet?
Well, it wasn't dropping the bomb on the AAA sites that were shooting on me. I'll tell you that. That was like a milk run, dare I say. I would say the most difficult thing that I did, and I would argue anyone can do, is land a high-performance fighter on an aircraft carrier at night when the ship is moving. Because if you think about a runway, right, we've all flown commercial. And if you fly from Los Angeles to Seattle, guess what? The airport is not anywhere other than where you expect it to be, and the runways are there.
And you really hope it's not moving.
Yeah, that's right. And it could be windy, it could be rainy, but the runway's there and it's really, really long. But when you're landing on an aircraft carrier, it's only about a 300-foot, 400-foot landing area. And oh, by the way, you're passing up some of it anyway, because you don't want to land on the very back end of it. And you land in a wire and it pulls you to a stop at about 200 feet from 130 knots. And it's violent. It's a controlled crash. And the aircraft that are designed to do that have to be very strong to withstand that. Well, now take that.
Does it hurt?
No, not really. It's kind of exhilarating, okay. But it's always, you know.
Is it like a little bit of whiplash when you get thrown backwards or anything?
Well, you get thrown forward because the aircraft is being pulled to a halt, right? Yeah. But now add some movement in the ship, right? Now, this ship, by the way, is 98,000 tons. It's almost 1,000 feet long. If you stood it on its tail, it'd be taller than the Empire State Building in Manhattan.
That's crazy.
But in right seas, that thing will move. And there is a particular occasion that is chronicled in the 2008 PBS carrier special where they had some particularly heinous seas one night. And I was on that ship and they were out there filming when I came back and landed. It took me 3 tries because the carrier, which is normally, let's call it at zero, right? If it's just stable, well, the back of the ship was moving up 20 feet and down 20 feet. So it's about 40-foot swings. And wow. It took me three tries to land because the first time I missed the whole carrier. I just didn't even, my wheels didn't touch down. Second time I touched down, but beyond the wires and missed them all. And the third time, by the grace of God and paddles, I landed in the wires and came to a halt and went down below and they stuck a camera in my face. And I'm glad that I said anything intelligent because that for me was the most scariest thing I've ever done.
And are there three wires on the deck?
There's three on some ships. There's four on the Nimitz, which what was I on that night? Yeah, that was the Nimitz. And then back in the old days, we had a fellow on our show when he used to land on carriers that were straight and not with an angle to them. And they would have 12 or 15 wires.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah. Well, Vincent, what is your favorite part of flying?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, there's so many things. The flying itself, just the majesty of flight, especially towards sunset or sunrise. Sunset's a little easier because you're not so tired. But just being up there where you're observing a sunset that nobody else in the world gets to see at that moment, unlike being on some pier right by the ocean with 100 other people that are watching it. It's as I like to say, it's as close to the hand or face of God as you can get in this lifetime. And, but also just when you fly, that power and control, you know, we talked earlier about how it's thrilling to be out of control on a roller coaster, but to be in control when you have the agility of a modern fighter and the excess thrust of the afterburners or reheat, as some folks call it, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. If you ride a motorcycle, you probably have a rough idea when you twist the throttle. Usually motorcycles respond very quickly. This is like that, but times 10. And it's amazing. But the other thing why I hesitated at the beginning is, as fun as all that is, what really keeps people around, I think, is the camaraderie of the other people who do it. And the men and women, the boys and girls, I shouldn't say that, but just to distinguish the younger folks who maintain the aircraft, It's impressive. I love it. I miss it. I don't get that in my airline capacity. It's noble, it's honorable, and it's wonderful. So all those things make it worthwhile. Anyone who might be wondering if a pursuit in such a field is for them, I say absolutely yes, go do it. Because if you find you don't like it, well, after some amount of time, they'll let you go. But if you are working in some 9-to-5 job in an office and you look out your window and see a military aircraft go by, you're always going to wonder why.
What's the fastest you've flown?
I was close to Mach 2 in the F-16. I think it was about 1.93. And by the time I got to that, I was at the far end of our training range and I'd used up most of my gas. And when I looked inside, because I was prosecuting some fighters, I was the pretend bad guy. I looked inside at my fuel and suddenly air was rushing through my teeth as I thought, uh-oh, I better knock off and head back to base. I don't know what the ground speed was on that, but almost twice the speed of sound.
Does it feel any different to go 1,000 miles an hour than it does to go 400 miles an hour?
You know what I tell people is, when you're on the highway and you're doing 70 miles an hour and you look out at a hill or a mountain in the distance and you think, that sucks, that's going by at all. But then suddenly a speed limit sign goes whizzing by 5 feet away. It's all that relative distance, right? So when I'm doing Mach 2 at 33,000 feet in an F-16, and I shouldn't put it that way because I didn't quite do that, but you get the point. Other than the rumble on the airframe and the air going over the canopy that you can sense, there's really no sensation of speed. Now, that's what's fun about flying by the clouds, because then you get that. But when you're doing a low level, or you're flying close to the ground or skimming, you know, something fun like boats all over the water or whatever, then you get that speed limit sign sensation I told you about. And that's a lot of fun. So even 300, 400 knots is fun when you're close to the ground or the water.
Now, your call sign is Jello. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, how do pilots get their call signs? Is it given to them by someone else? Do you create your own? Is it a rite of passage? Is it mandatory to have a call sign to fly?
Well, Daniel, I would refer you and your listeners to episode 2 of the Fighter Pilot Podcast from January 1st, 2018, where we covered this ad nauseum. And
well, then I'll tell you what, you know what? Then don't answer, because it'll give my listeners something else to go listen to, and then they can go find out for themselves.
All right,
I love
there's it. Your homework. But I will promise you it's worth listening to. It's quite funny.
Do pilots generally have an understanding of the mechanics of their aircraft? I know there's a team that supports you, but like, you know, could you ever get down there and assist if there was a problem, or are you just hands on the controls only and not involved in the mechanics?
Well, yes and no to all of that. And I don't mean to vacillate, but we are expected to understand the different systems in our fighters very well, because if there's a problem, you want to know, oh, this isolation valve, by closing this or opening that, that means I'll lose my landing gear, but not my flaps, etc. So you want to know your systems, hydraulics, engines, life support, flight controls, armament, all those things. As far as getting out and lending a hand, no, because you have to be qualified to do that. And not to say other people don't understand how to remove an engine or do things. There are probably pilots who understand all that real well. I never did. And so to go down to maintenance and say, hey, I want to help you change this engine or whatever. I mean, they might give you a menial task to do that they could supervise you doing, but no, you're not out there turning wrenches.
Well, I mean, and I'm like to think I'm a very good driver, but I have no idea how an engine actually, if it breaks down, how to fix it. I mean, I just, you know, I understand the general concepts of automobiles, but I don't, you know, I could change an oil maybe.
Well,
but,
not to go on too big a tangent, Daniel, but 40, 50 years ago, it was very easy to understand it. But cars these days are so advanced. Plus there's no room to crawl in under the hood anymore. You know, you used to be able to get your body in there and figure out what's wrong and adjust the points or change the spark plugs or whatever. And now it takes a PhD, it feels like.
So, okay. Fun question. What happens if you have to go to the bathroom and you're in the middle of a flight?
We'll preempt that by saying the first thing you do before you go to the equipment place and put on your flight gear is go to the bathroom. So you want to take care of it. And if there's any hint of number two, then you definitely spend a few minutes and make sure that, okay, that's not a problem. It's really not an issue. Or, okay, good. Now I'm evacuated. And so off we go. We have what are called piddle packs. And there are some YouTube videos around. I was going to do one and someone else beat me to it. So I might still, but eventually it wasn't going to be a demonstration. Don't get me wrong. It was just going to be an explanation. But imagine a little rolled up plastic bag with very thick plastic where there's an opening that you can unzip your flight suit and then you can urinate into this tube that is structured so that inside is either a little bit of a sand type of thing that coagulates, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word, or a sponge that fills up. But either way, the idea is you don't want it to be able to spill out if it turns over. So it kind of turns into mud or a full sponge. And then you wrap it up. It's got a little zip tie kind of thing on it. And you seal it up and you put it over to the side of you. And when you get back, you were supposed to take it down to medical in the on the flight deck. And invariably, I hate to admit it, for the environmentalists out there, but most of the time it accidentally got chucked overboard into the ocean.
Now, what about, I assume they have these for women as well that are designed slightly differently.
I understand it's difficult for them. Stand from our U2 guest who was on the show, who was a real character. Again, go listen to that one. But there were some diaper type things that they could wear that would absorb it and keep it away from private parts that could otherwise be not, you know, you don't want to sit in that stuff. I guess it's not healthy.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I don't know these days if female fighter pilots are doing that, or if they have some sort of adapter for the piddle packs or what they do. But, you know, you do fly some longer flights, so you've got to do something.
Yeah. Are there more women today flying as fighter jet pilots than there were back in the day?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a time in the early, prior to the early 90s, where females could not be in combat roles at all. And so you might remember history from World War II, there was the WASPs, and they would fly the aircraft to the different locations and drop them off, but the females were prevented from being in combat. And then later they were flying, but not combat aircraft. And about the time I came in 1992 is about the time that was finally restricted, or lifted, I should say, that restriction was lifted. And females began to serve alongside males. And frankly, I think that's a good thing because it, you know, granted there are dynamics in the ready room of male and female and black and white and anything. I mean, anytime you have more than one person, right, you're going to have some friction. Daniel, if you and I were stuck in a car for a 24-hour road trip, right, something I was doing would start to bother you and vice versa. So you're always going
to
have
to listen to
dynamics.
Some music I don't like.
That's
or
right,
whatever.
That's right.
Yeah.
But when it comes right down to it, if I'm fighting another aircraft, I don't care who's in that aircraft. I don't care what equipment they have or the color of the skin. And I care what they can do. And if they're going to shoot me down before I can shoot them down, well, then they're the better fighter pilot that day. And if I can defeat them, well, then I am. But I really wish the world would get around to this because I think we still make too big a deal of it. And before I stop talking on that, because I want to be mindful of it, I recognize that there are still leftover systemic issues in society where maybe little girls don't think it's okay to be fighter pilots or aren't told they can, and that people of different races don't have the opportunities. And so I look forward to the day where that's no longer an issue.
I do too. I look forward to a day when everyone can have an opportunity and the color of your skin or your gender just is irrelevant.
Absolutely.
And it's just based on your skills, who you are, and
yep.
Agreed. So you were an instructor at Top Gun, and I'm really curious, how is it doing that, and how different is it, of course, than you see in the movie?
Right.
What's it really like?
Well, how much homework can we give your listeners? Because episode 7 we titled Top Gun versus Top Gun, and we deliberately did that, although it sounds redundant. The movie is two words, both capitalized, or the first letter is TNG, and the schoolhouse is one word, all capital.
All capitalized,
but it's not an acronym, so that's just the way they decided to do it. And so a good friend of mine who is deployed currently was the commanding officer of Top Gun at the time, and we recorded a great discussion, and I even poked some fun at, okay, what, so no volume all day long? And so it's totally different. And the point we make, and I make this a lot of places on the Fighter Pilot podcast, is if movies really reflected reality, nobody would pay the $10 to go, because it'd be boring, Daniel. It would be god awful. And so they have to make it fun. And hopefully the forthcoming Top Gun Maverick will do more of the same. And we'll have to suspend reality for those of us who have been there, because nobody wants to see a 3-hour debrief. I mean, you go out, you spend 5 hours preparing for a 1-hour flight and 3 hours debriefing it, and maybe the other way around. But if all you do is sit in the debrief and that's your 2-hour movie, that's not fun, but that's where the learning happens. And so it's very much different, and rightfully so.
So when you're teaching as an instructor, do you know right away if you're dealing with a good student versus someone who's probably not going to make it through?
Well, you know, I would defer that question to someone who taught flight school, which I never did. By the time you instruct at Top Gun, those people are hand selected. And so with rare occasions, most of them make it through. I guess what I'm trying to say is most of them make it through. On rare occasion, we have an attrition, and it's a bummer, but you can kind of see them struggling, and either they get it or they don't. And at least at Top Gun, there's a very high standard for the benefit of wearing that patch. And if you don't meet it, you don't get it. And it's unfortunate, but that's the way it's got to be.
So that's interesting that by the time they get there, this is like the graduate school of graduate schools. Have to be cream of the crop to get there. Okay.
That's right.
Well, the two most important Top Gun movie questions we're going to ask, and then we'll get off that subject, is one, have you ever done the inverted middle finger to somebody while you're flying? And two, have you ever eaten at the Kansas City Barbecue Top Gun Bar in San Diego?
No, and yes, but it was in 2000, I think it was, well before I lived here in San Diego. And it's since burned down, unfortunately. They lost a lot of the original artwork, and I think the original piano. Yeah, but they rebuilt. And I've not been back since. I understand it's a bit of a tourist location. So it's not something on my list. I don't take friends when they come. We go to the USS Midway across the way, which is really interesting, right there on the
wharf. Cool.
No, I know where it is, but that's about the end of it.
Is there a movie that you've seen that actually got fighter jet maneuvers and experiences correct, or at least close to being right?
Well, Top Gun did, and Top Gun Maverick will as well. Now, granted, yes, they did the inverted middle finger thing, which is unrealistic, but the flying scenes were real. And on the upcoming movie, the flying scenes are real. Now, to be fair, they've spliced some together, but it's two real splices that, you know, look amazing. But yeah, they wouldn't let these guys fly in such close formation as they do in some of the scenes we've seen on the trailers. And so I think those movies are very realistic. Behind Enemy Lines isn't very realistic in some regards. I actually had a chance over COVID 2020, you might remember, when everything was first locked down, some of the different online channels were looking for people that had setups in their home that could help them. And so I think it was Business Insider and Vanity Fair both reached out to me and said, hey, would you be willing to do some fighter pilot reacts, you know, videos for us? And so we talked about, like, Iron Man had some F-22s, if you remember. We even did, what was it, The Incredibles? You know, of course, it's a cartoon, but there's a scene in there where I forget the Stretch Lady's character name, but, you know, she's evading some missiles, and Behind Enemy Lines and Top Gun, and golly, what were the other movies we did?
The Schwarzenegger movie.
Yeah, True Lies. Yep, that was the one I was just thinking of. Which that was a good one too. But yeah, I mean, again, they have to make it exciting.
Well, I'll link to those videos. I'll link to that video in the show notes so people can see that as well.
Oh, good.
I'm curious, do pilots age out at some point? Is there a point where, like, your body just won't take the G-forces and whatnot?
Well, that's more of a... There's two questions here. The first one is, the older you get, generally the more senior in rank you get. And the more senior in rank you get, the fewer flying opportunities there are for you. So in that regard, yes. But as far as the effect on your body, some people succumb to the injuries, if you will, of flying a fighter earlier than others. It's not uncommon to have a bad neck or shoulder or other parts for fighter pilots. In fact, right now there's some hubbub in the news about why are military pilots having higher susceptibility to certain types of cancers, which is not the question you asked. But the point simply being is my neck used to hurt a lot just because you're wearing an 8 or more pound helmet that then you're twisting your neck and pulling G's and looking for the guy behind you. Again, if you've seen Top Gun, you've seen Maverick and Goose, right? You know, yeah. Kind of stretching around in the flight deck there. But it can be painful on the body, but some people can do it longer. There's a gentleman in Australia who, his name is right on the tip of my tongue. We're trying to get him to come on the show, but I think he's in his early 60s and he's been flying for decades and he's just got the, the unicorn body that can do it. And he loved it and he was teaching. And so I think he finally retired after, I don't know how many thousands of hours, but some people last longer than others.
Did you know an F-35 fighter jet is made up of approximately 50,000 fasteners? High-strength nuts, bolts, washers, rivets, and other aviation-grade fasteners are also used on spacecraft, race cars, and even do-it-yourself projects by hobbyists. If your next project at work or at home calls for mil-spec aerospace hardware, look to DNL Components Incorporated. DNL Components consults space manufacturers, engineering companies, and high-tech startups on hardware availability, application, and alternatives that may lower cost or be more readily available without compromising quality. DNL Components sources alloy steel, A286, titanium, Inco 718, and other Krez materials for bolts, washers, nuts, rivets, Hilox, hydraulic fittings, and more, or they can custom machine when you submit your prints and specs. Go to dnlcomponents.com to learn more and to schedule a consultation with Donnie or Larry. That's dnlcomponents.com.
Is it difficult for you to drive, 35 miles per hour or 55 miles per hour because you've gone so fast?
Oh, yeah. I'm already an old fart. I turned 50 last year, and I pretty much leave early so I can set a couple over the speed limit, and that's the end of it. I do still have a sport bike, though, back to the motorcycle analogy. And when I get on that thing, you remember that cartoon a long time ago, Mr. Walker and Mr. Wheeler, where the pedestrian? Oh, it's a funny one. I'll have to see if I can find it. I'll link it to you. But it's this whimsical cartoon about this nice gentleman who gets in his car and he turns into this radical person, and drives like a maniac. And so when I get on my motorcycle, I might dial it up a little bit because it's like the good old days, but that's about it.
Did you ever consider quitting any time in your career?
No, not really. When I was young, I knew I wanted to be taken care of by the Navy. So I wanted to retire. And I did. The day I retired, the next day, I still had medical benefits and I could go on base and shop at the commissary and the exchange and get gas cheaper and all that. So I knew I wanted to do that. I'd hoped to be a commanding officer, but the Navy didn't need my services in that capacity. So I did it as long as I could and had a great time doing it. And I have no regrets. There was a time I thought about maybe leaving the Navy and going to like an Air National Guard unit, but I was too much of a wuss to embrace the change of doing that. So I just stuck with what I knew.
Well, so today you fly for one of the major airlines, and I'm curious, how is it different than flying jets beyond the fact that your cargo is people, and do you like one more than the other, or are they just that different?
Oh, no comparison. I would go back to my old life in a heartbeat, except that, I was gone a lot, of course, and then military. Now, maybe I shouldn't say that because there are now companies that fly demilitarized fighter jets for contract for the government. And a couple of them have reached out to me. And frankly, I've said no, only because I don't want to be gone any more than I already am. But it's totally different. I mean, take a race car driver and put them in the city bus. And that's basically what you're doing. And so what the airline for me lacks is the sense of nobility and purpose in romance of a fighter, if you will. It's still honorable, don't get me wrong. I enjoy doing it. COVID's kind of soured it a little bit for me, to be completely honest. I live in San Diego and used to be based in Los Angeles. And then I was kind of put on the sidelines for a while, but they were still paying me, which was great. but now they want to put me back to work. And so I took a leave of absence thinking, hey, look, let me just sit this out. You don't have to pay me. But now they said, no, we want you back and we want you to fly from New York City. And nothing against my friends in New York City. I just don't want to fly 5 hours each way to start my work day. So I'm still in a bit of a food fight with my company over that right now and trying to avoid that. But alas, it looks like they're going to win. It's either that or quit. And that's not a smart move. So I'll probably have to do that for a little while, but everything for a season, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you look back now at 50 years old, what's the most valuable insight you think you've learned from your careers?
Respect, probably. Respect for power, respect for authority, respect for life. I've watched friends perish in front of me, which is heartbreaking. And I've learned that things go by quickly and you need to respect that the time you have is fleeting. I remember as being a young pilot, an old guy came in and said, I would trade anything to be with you. It goes by quickly, you know, enjoy every minute. I'm like, yeah, whatever, beat it. And I found myself saying that to someone, I forget what the setting was, but within the last couple of years. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm that guy now. And, yeah. You know, just to be present in the moment and respect where you are, what you're doing, even if, Daniel, it's not where you want to be and what you want to do, which is why I'm lambasting myself about getting all upset about having to go to New York. There's going to be some good that comes from it. I just don't see it yet. But we get a lot of people who write in or call in or, you know, talk to me on the Fighter Pilot podcast about wanting to be fighter pilots and, oh, what happens if I have to fly helicopters or I have to fly these other airplanes? And whenever I have people on the show who fly those, I always make a point to ask them, hey, did you want to fly this? And what do you think of it now? Daniel, just to wrap this up, I'll tell you, we had a gentleman on the show, Niles, love the guy, lives right here in San Diego. He wanted to be a fighter pilot. He ended up an E2 backseater. So he's in the tube in the dark, working the radar. And he told me later he loved it. He found his personality suited it. He was good at it. He enjoyed doing it. There was elements of it that he thrived in. So what is it called? You know, blossom where you planted or whatever. I think people really need to respect the way things go. Call it God, call it Darwin, call it whatever. We are where we are for a reason. And so embrace it instead of resisting it. I'm not perfect at that still.
I don't know that we ever are perfect at it. It's something that I also still struggle with a bit and try to get better at every day, which is maybe the point, you know, but I don't know if we ever have the answer. So if you find out, let me know.
Yeah. Well, I think you touched on the exact point, right? Is we're all in this race called life, but it's not a race. It's not a finish line. What's the finish line? A coffin? You know, the race. And so let's enjoy the race the best we can. And so
The point of the journey is not to arrive, as they say.
Yeah, you know? There you go. See, that's why
go ahead. Good. No, please. Go
ahead. I was just going to say, that's why you're so much more of an eloquent podcast host than I am. So well said.
well, thank you. Thank you. I'll take the compliment. As a guy who's traveled so many places in the world and obviously flown so much, is vacation for you just being home with the family or do you still like to go places?
Well, I'll tell you. For a period of time last year, Daniel, I had 3 teenage boys in my house. So without getting too graphic, assuming this is a family show, but this is Family Matters. I mean,
no, you can be graphic. It's R-rated. It's fine.
We had to open the windows. I mean, the house smells a lot. I'll put it that way. My wife is like a single mom with 4 boys. I mean, it's ugly, messy, smelly, you know, and of course the 2 older ones have discovered girls and music and everything else. And so I won't say my house is not a place of comfort and rest, although a lot of times it's not, that's true. But I do, of course, love my family. We work through all the ups and downs and we have fun. For me, if you're really asking, my happy place is on a trout stream with a fly rod in my hand. That is, I find that the water rushing by my legs takes away all my problems. And to fool a gorgeous trout into taking your artificial fly and fighting it and having an opportunity to connect with his world for a little while and then releasing him again. And, you know, if the opportunity exists to eat it, I'm not afraid to do that too, to be honest, but more often than not, the places I go, you have to release them and that's fine by me because then you can catch them another day. That's where my heart flutters.
That's cool. Well, if you hadn't been a pilot, what do you think you would have been?
Hard to say. I do pretty well with numbers. I like details and organization and schedules. So again, the military was probably good for me. I think I could probably do okay in business. I don't know that I'd be good in sales. I don't necessarily like to persuade people, although I guess someone would say the best way to do sales is just to live it. But probably something where I could, you know, make a difference, organize things, track schedules and budgets and have fun doing it. So probably some sort of business.
What would be the title of your autobiography?
Well, so I knew this question was coming and I purposely said it earlier because I ended up saying this, I forget where, but someone wrote me for the podcast and said, hey, that would be the greatest title for your autobiography. And I thought, good idea. So by the grace of God and paddles, because again, I'm not suggesting everyone needs to believe what I believe, but I do believe that I've been blessed. And I also believe that a lot of my ability to land on the carrier and do the things that I did was because of people like paddles. And if your listeners aren't aware, that's the nickname for the landing signal officers, who are your fellow pilots who stand out on the back of the carrier and bring you home safely day and night. And so I think it's got a good ring to it. And I wish I remembered who suggested it so I could give credit where credit was due, but probably that.
I love it. I love it. What was your favorite childhood book?
You know, I don't really remember. We used to love The Cat in the Hat and some of the Dr. Seuss stuff. And then when my kids were younger, we used to read Pandora. It's a little whimsical book about a cat who gets kind of out of favor with the parents because they have a baby. And I always had fun changing the story up because that one was so ripe for, you know, just changing the story a little bit, like Beat It Cat, you know, and instead of drinking tea, they're drinking beer or something. And my kids love that. But yeah, you know, I guess if I had to narrow it down to one, maybe Dr. Seuss.
What's a movie you've seen in your life that made you cry or something that still does?
Oh, I can cry at just about anything, to be honest with you. We were watching Braveheart, The Patriot, which is basically the revolutionary Braveheart, right? Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that with Mel Gibson, but he's
Mel Gibson. Yeah,
yeah, he's got the young daughter who's kind of, you know, the mom dies, and so she's obviously going through some trouble, and you know, poor I forget Mel's character name, but you know, he's trying to win her over the whole time, and then towards the end, she finally comes out saying "Don't leave" and talking, and I always have a soft spot, I should say, for anything where there's that family connection. And I think that's partly because my mother and father divorced when I was very young, and my father was kind of distant, even though he wasn't far away. So I don't know if you ever saw October Sky, the story about the West Virginia boy.
It's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah,
of
mine
all time.
Too. And I just love the redemption with the with the father and the son. I really love We Were Soldiers as well. It's one of my favorites. And so,
have you read the book October Sky? Because it's
a little
bit different than the movie.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. Say. Yeah.
That I always tell people that's one book that I got to the end of the book, and when he starts in the epilogue, when he's kind of telling you what happened and everything, I was actually crying so hard reading the book that I couldn't see the words on the page. I had to like wipe my eyes several times. It was a great, great book.
Yeah. No, I do still get emotional at different things. I really loved Lone Survivor. I read that book twice. As soon as I finished the last page, I turned back to the beginning, started over. Same with Black Hawk Down. And I think, again, I just have a spot in my heart. Maybe it's because it feels like it was lacking with a father figure that was somewhat missing as a child. But anywhere there's that bond, and it doesn't have to just be between men, you know, with whatever, however it goes, just where there's that connection where people have something traumatic that happens, or there's that connect, you know, that sudden moment of bonding. And I guess that's why The Patriot got me the other night, just when the little girl finally connected with her dad. I just thought that was really touching.
Well, how do you think your focus in life has changed as you've gotten older? What was different for you at 20 that's different today?
Oh, I'm glad to say a lot, because I was a wreck as a young guy. I took, and I guess, so you've seen a hint of it already, right? I've been sitting here moaning about, oh, I have to go to, you know, I fly for a major airline and they want me to go to New York. Oh, suck it up, buttercup. You know, it's like when I was young, I took any apparent travesties on my plan as personal, and how could you not let me do this this is what I want to do. And so I was wound up, I think, a little tighter when I was younger, tend to internalize things, tend to take things personally, which is funny because we always tell young fighter pilots, like, look, you gotta have thick skin. And so I've definitely mellowed out. I had a rather major life event when I was 39 years old medically that I haven't shared with my own show yet, so I'm not going to give you all the details, but that was one of those events where it could, in fact, a friend of mine just lost his brother, the exact same thing, undiagnosed. And that's what they told me, is had they not taken care of it, I could have just dropped dead mowing the lawn one Saturday. And so I think for me, 39 was that pivot point between young and untouchable and partying all night and bars and clubs and things. I mean, don't get me wrong, I wasn't a womanizer, but I love to live at large. I mean, that's what you do as a fighter pilot. You work hard, play hard. Since then, I was laughing at myself the other night. I was watching my clock. It's like, all right, as soon as it gets 9 o'clock, I'm going to bed. And it was Friday. And I was like, oh, for heaven's sakes, that's awful. But you know, my young kids are trying to get out there and take the torch for me. So that's good enough for me.
What are your hobbies? What do you do with your off hours?
Well, you know, one
besides
of them.
Besides fly fishing.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. I still like to snow ski, although it's getting harder every year. And, I like to ride my motorcycle. I've got an old muscle car I like to tinker out with and work on. Honestly, the biggest take of my time is family and the podcast. And that's pretty much my day.
Well, I'm curious. It's 8 o'clock at night. You have the house to yourself and you're going to dance around your underwear or whatever, like Tom Cruise. What kind of song would you put on? What's your jam?
Well, first off, if I'm going to dance around, I'm going full naked because why not? But anyway,
good
sorry.
Man, good
disturbing,
man.
I know. I'll probably take a lot of grief for this, but Shake It Off, Taylor Swift. That's a fun one. Mm. I really like that one. If I'm in the right mood.
That's a good song.
Yeah, if I'm in the right mood, I'll jump around to that. But then I might turn around and put on System of a Down, which is a little bit like thrash metal, but you know, some of it's not. Yeah. I really like Pink Floyd. I probably listen to more of that and Roger Waters than anything. And that's probably partly to do with the fact that I'm kind of mellowing with age.
That's the era. That's the music of our childhood too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, same age. So
I was telling my 20-year-old son, who's really into music. We share a lot of taste, although he likes more of the other stuff that I don't. But, I told him, I said, when I was in college at UCLA, I think I listened to The Wall all the way through every single day somehow. Mm. And I would just have it on in the apartment or while I was studying. But, I listen to a lot of Pink Floyd or Roger Waters, and I love 80s rock as well. My wife and I really love the 80s music. So it just depends on the mood I'm in. Sometimes I'll actually exercise to mellow music, believe it or not. You know, it's like, it's not just the speed metal. I'll put on something kind of, you know, heart warming, I guess. I don't know what to call it.
It actually focuses you quite a bit.
Right.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What did you make for dinner last night?
Last night we had one of those meal in a boxes that comes to your door. I think it was a Blue Apron, actually. So if they're listening, thank you very much. you get the instructions out. It's got all the ingredients, and we put it together and put on some music and have a little fun with it. But you know, I can do okay on a grill. I've got a pasta salad I can make, and I can probably not screw up spaghetti. But other than that, I'm no chef.
What's your favorite food?
Probably my all-time favorite food is watermelon.
That's awesome.
A cold watermelon on a hot summer day, man, there is nothing better. I love that.
If you could sit down for 4 hours in an old-timey pub somewhere in the world with any person from all of human history, alive or dead, excluding your own family members or any kind of religious prophet, who would you sit down with? What would you drink? And what's the first question you'd want to ask them?
Oh, man. Well, I guess that rules out Jesus. Let's see. You know, I've been asked this one before, and it always strikes me as kind of odd because I tend to not spend a lot of time driving in the rearview mirror. I tend to look ahead, and maybe to my own detriment because I don't really think sometimes too much about what I'm doing right now. And I just released a blog about that on my own website recently. But maybe one of the founding fathers, like what it was really like. I mean, we know the end story now, right? But for George Washington and all those guys that were there at the beginning, during all the articles and everything they had to go through, and then the Revolutionary War, you know, we have the benefit now of knowing how it ended, but what was it really like?
Yeah.
And did they know that this idea was going to work? And that, in fact, we're all men created equal, because at the time, it sure seemed like certain ones weren't treated equally. Yeah. And so I think to sit down with a group of them and I feel badly that, you know, I don't know about you, by the way, Daniel, when I turn on a microphone, I'm instantly half as smart as I was before. And that's not very good. So I'd love to be able to rattle off a bunch more of the names of the people that were there. I don't know. Is there a Patrick, somebody, and a Adams? And anyway,
we'll just stick with George Washington.
Let's go with him. Exactly.
Or maybe, all right. So you and George Washington are sitting in an old timey bar. What are you going to drink?
Oh, I love a good old beer. And I don't know if they had IPAs back then, but that's what I'm on right now. So a nice 8% IPA. And a pint is going to do me just right. And I think I'm going to ask him, you know, I guess it depends on when we're talking, of course, but you know, how did you know, or did you know that this was going to work? And, or did you just exude the leadership you felt they needed to know that you had it all together? Because that's one thing, not to derail the question, but I think a lot of leaders are just frankly messes of people. I know I am. I mean, people look up to me now that I have this podcast, but I tell them, I'm like, look, I'm a wreck. You know, I'm still bad at things. I still piss my wife off after 20, however many years of marriage. I still say stupid things to my kids and my parents. And I'm not amazing. You see a part of me on this podcast, but you know, so I wonder these other people that we have these enormous outlooks of, or reputations, how do they think of themselves? Well, you know, Thomas Jefferson.
I'll tell you what. I've interviewed people from so many different walks of life and from all different countries of the world. And the one thing I can tell you that there's many things that actually bind us together as human beings. But one of the things that they all have in common, and these are people that are leaders, you know, Academy Award winners, mm-hmm. public, you know, award-winning authors, all that stuff. They'll all say the same thing, which is if anybody tells you that they have it all figured out, they're full of shit.
Yeah.
We all just do our best, you know?
Yeah. Tim Ferriss has a really good book out called Tools of Titans. It's like 600 pages. It rehashes a lot of the big names that he's had on this podcast. And there's a couple of people in there that say the same thing. You know, it's like, look, fake it till you make it or whatever the other cliche is. But, you know, don't believe people that act like they have it all together or say that they do. And don't assume everybody does, but figure out what's your strength and work on that and what's your weakness and get someone to help you with it. I really loved it. I listened to a podcast the other day because we all think, oh, we're going to work on our weaknesses and get better. And this show I was listening to was with Andy Stanley. The guy was saying, hey, look, I'm not left-handed. I'm right-handed. Now, I could practice getting better writing left-handed and I would probably make some gains. But why should I? Why don't I just write with my right hand? And if there's some chore or task that requires it to be written left-handed, let me find someone who's left-handed. And I thought, there you go. That's the perfect example, right? It's like, I have a natural bent for being right-handed. Let me find someone who can do this left-handed. And my mother's left-handed. Yes. So, hey, go for it.
Play to your strengths. Exactly. Yeah. Vincent, if you could travel in time, where would you go?
I think I would like to go back to, I don't even know when, but before Los Angeles was a city. And look at the basin that is now Los Angeles, because when you've flown over Los Angeles, now if you've done it in an airliner, that's one thing, but when you fly over Los Angeles in a fighter, and even at 20,000 feet, all you can see almost in any direction except the ocean, of course, are lights, if it's at night, of course, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy. I can't begin to imagine what it must have looked like back before then, when there was rivers and I think salmon, and if you go back far enough, you know, different saber-toothed tigers and different things that still bubble up right in downtown LA at the tar pits. It's crazy. So I think I would have loved to have seen California when there was still 50-pound, you know, steelhead swimming up rivers and everything wasn't molested by man. I think before, don't get me wrong, I'm not a raging environmentalist, but I do agree that we've done some damage to the planet. Now, whether that's like a localized bite from a flea on a dog, and as soon as the flea is dead and the dog scratches it, it's over, I don't know. But I do know that we've done some real detriment to certain parts of it. And it'd be nice to see it in its native, pristine, pre-white man, I guess, dare I say, condition.
Yeah, that would be something incredible to see, actually. I'm curious, what quality in human beings do you most admire?
Forgiveness. I think it's amazing when people can do it. I don't think all people can do it, and I think I still struggle with it. I'm still a little bit, you know, frankly, bitter at my dad for different things, and there's nothing I can do now because he's gone.
Are you afraid of dying?
I think only a fool would say no, honestly. I'll put it to you this way. I recognize I'm going to die. And every time I tell my wife she's going to die, she hates it. And I say, honey, denying it isn't going to help.
Yeah,
I feel like you do yourself a disservice by denying it. I think you need to embrace it, that day in, day out, nobody knows the time or place, but we're going to die. And as I mentioned earlier, Daniel, I've witnessed death. I saw my two friends perish right off a catapult on an aircraft carrier. I actually was the one who discovered my father when he was in hospice in the middle of the night when he finally slipped. And
I was with my father when he passed away.
Is that right? And that's something you don't forget.
Nope.
So I wish I could say I have absolute certainty of where I'm going to go next and how things are going to be. And that I would be lying if I said that was true. I have my doubts. The world constantly bombards us to think different things. And so, but I guess I have faced it, experienced it in a sense, obviously not my own, but, you know, been around it enough to know that it's coming and that you need to be prepared and that you might as well live like it could be any time, even though I don't do that. I try to hope that I do at least as much as I can. So I think...
But wait, I want to just comment on that because what I think an important distinction to say on the show is that I actually agree with you that, you know, you should live your life as if it's going to end tomorrow. But the problem is that a lot of people take that to mean like, oh, well, I should just go party do a bunch of drugs and be crazy. And that's not what we're saying. Yeah. What we're saying is to love the people around you, to cherish your family, to cherish the relationships, to cherish being alive and experiencing this world. That's at least what I'm saying when I say, you know, live your life like it's going to end tomorrow. It's appreciate everything and don't sweat the small stuff, honestly.
I don't think I could say it better. And I wish I could say I do all those things, but it's again, right? It's the journey. So that's the daily, that's the daily chore for us, is to find a way to do that and make a difference in someone's life. So I think, just to answer it more succinctly, to summarize, I think when, if I know it's near, right, if it's a week away and I know it, versus a sudden plane crash or accident, car crash, that any fear I may have is that now there's no chance for any hope for doing the things I want to do or making the difference I want to make. And so a smart person would go do that now, right? Hey, I've always wanted to go here. I've always wanted to do this with my wife. I've always wanted to say this to that person who wronged me and forgive them. If I know it's coming and I haven't done it, the fear of is probably the only fear I harbor, I feel like.
What do you hope people say about you at your funeral?
I hope they'll say that he tried and that he was a good person. I personally don't know. I've always struggled with, believe it or not, self-confidence, to the point where my brothers especially would get on me about it. They'd say, you know, what's your deal? And I'd say, it's not that I think so highly of everyone else. I think I just don't, for whatever reason, think highly enough of myself. And I wonder if other people get that, and if they'll somehow comment on that. In the end, I guess I just want people to say he was all right. And by all right, meaning he did, like, I don't plan to be, I don't hope to be, I don't aspire to be someone who's like high schools are named after him, right? Like George Washington, or whose legacy lives on and everybody's mourning, you know, flags are half mast when I'm gone. When I'm gone, I don't want it to be a big deal. I want to be gone. And I want people to say he made a difference. He was all right. And we respect the effort, and we're sad he's gone, but it's okay. Let's move on. And so, I don't know, maybe that's not grandiose enough, but like I said, I never thought of myself too super high. And I would say that when the end comes, I wouldn't expect anyone to all of a sudden make me out to be someone I wasn't.
And not to play therapist, but do you think that your feelings of what you just talked about stem from your dad leaving at a young age? Because that's a hard thing for a young man or a young woman to experience. And is there a part of you that feels like, well, if I were good enough, dad wouldn't have left? Because if that's the case, it wasn't about you. It was never about you. You know what I mean? Right. And it has nothing to do with you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a valid question. I mean, if you really were to lay people out on the psychiatrist's couch, right, or psychologist, I think you'd find all kinds of things. I mean, I see it in other people, and I think, yes, that absolutely is true. I mean, we were all deprived the attention of our father, which was made worse by the fact that he was close, but wouldn't give it. And so when I say we all, I mean my siblings and I. Mm. And so, yeah, I think so. So for example, I hate being disrespected. That's the one thing I tell my kids, like, look, you can do different things, but please do not disrespect me or your mother. And I think part of that was also amplified by the Navy a little bit, dare I say. I was fortunate to get almost everything I wanted. I mean, I didn't get into the Naval Academy, but that was fine. I had a good time at ROTC. I got flight school. I got jets. I got F-18s. I got Top Gun. It wasn't until later on where they didn't accept me to be a commanding officer. And that stung, you know? And so I guess there's a part of me that wants to prove myself to the Navy as well. Like, hey, look, you know, you missed out. Or, hey, dad, look, we could have had this relationship. So yeah, I absolutely think that deep down, you know, lay me out, really fillet the feelings back and find out what's in there. And it's probably carried leftover hurt and wondering if some of it was self-induced.
What do you think? Well, it's a whole other podcast to talk about what to do with that.
Yeah. Well, but I don't mind saying it, because the one thing I like to say on my show is it's authentic, it's real, it's factual, it's personal. It's like, what you see is what you get. When people meet me, they say, oh, I feel like I know you. I say, well, you do. You hear me. This is the real me on the show. And this is the real me now. I mean, yeah, if you watch me, you know, get dressed, guess what? One leg and then the other.
Well, it may not help. It may help. I don't know. But for whatever it's worth, I think you're an awesome guy.
Well, thank you. I will say, if I may address that, that I haven't taken the crazy pill, But the podcast has definitely allowed me to have my own therapy in a sense of,
yes,
people do like me. People like what I'm putting out. And it's not perfect. I mean, I make mistakes every single episode.
Me too.
And yeah. And it's like, it's okay. If they like me, I need to like me. And I think I do a good job of that. Now, if nothing else, dear listeners, if you struggle with any of these things we've talked about, start a podcast because it's actually quite good for you.
I agree completely. It is so cathartic. I have found many answers to my own life talking to other people. It's fantastic.
And it's never been easier to start a podcast, for heaven's sakes. You can get a microphone on Amazon for $50. You got a laptop. It's probably got GarageBand or else you can get Audacity for free. And then you can upload it. It's super easy, people.
I agree. What superpower would you choose?
Oh, flying, like Superman. I mean, come on. basically, pretty much do that in an F-16. It's like being on the tip of a rocket, and the thing is so powerful. And the F-18, with the way the canopy closes, there's this little metal bar right at the top of your head. And it somewhat occludes the view. Well, the F-16, the whole canopy comes down together and it's just like sitting out in space. So it's really close, but yeah, to be able to fly like Superman, I think it's gotta be as good as it gets.
That's awesome. If you could tell your younger self anything, what would it be?
Chill. Don't worry.
You know that everybody says this. Every single person over the age of 40 says they would tell their younger selves to just relax, enjoy life more. I wonder if it just wouldn't work, you know?
No, because I think if you found the 20-year-old Vincent and you said, hey, your 50-year-old Vincent says, chill, what do you want to tell him? Dude, get back in the game, you old geezer. You know, get fired up, get out there, get excited about
off.
Something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think chill, not so much as don't have the energy and passion. I think passion was a word that was used to describe me a lot at different times. I think it was a polite way of saying, all right, you know, if we can get him going the right direction, it's great, but otherwise he's a bit of a wild card. But I think to roll with the punches maybe is another thing I would say, right? So that's kind of a longer term for chill, but just realize that again, as we said earlier, it may not go exactly the way you want to go it, but it's going to go the right way, whether you think so or not.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. Well said,
Thank
by
you.
The way.
Thank you.
Well, Vincent, what do you think is the meaning of life?
I think the meaning of life is to try to figure out the meaning of life. I mean, you can take so many different looks at this, right? One is, well, we're only here for a short period of time. We might as well live it up, right? And just party like you were talking about earlier. And who cares about tomorrow? And squander your whatever gifts you have and wealth that you may have and just go live it up. What was it? Live fast, die young, have a good looking corpse. The other is on the more religious or philosophical side is we're here for a reason and we should pursue what that is and do it. And then I think for everybody who's kind of stuck in the middle, it's, well, I don't know. And it's too hard of a question. So I'm just going to do this, right? And I think it's why, I'm no psychologist, but I think it's why people will stay with an abusive spouse. Or loved one, because I guess maybe I shouldn't call a loved one, but you know, they stay in abusive relationships, I should say, because they're people don't like change or whatever, or the job sucks and it's ruining their life, but they don't have the gumption, for lack of a better word, to get out of it and go do it. And I think really what people should do is, what is my purpose? Why are we here? What are we doing? And what can I do if my job is simply to serve as a support for someone else, then okay, that's maybe what I need to do. But if you feel like there's something more there, there's a tugging at your spirit or whatever it is that you need to go figure it out, then go figure it out. And I commented on that earlier. For people who think they want to go do something, and I use of course, the military thing, you know, you don't want to be sitting in some office looking out the window, wishing or wondering. Go try it and figure it out. Now, obviously you have to temper that with certain things. You can't just jump off a bridge with no parachute or bungee cord and say you want to go try it. But for realistic things, if there's a tugging at your spirit on being a singer or, you know, walking somewhere crazy or running something or riding a bike or whatever it is, don't deny that. Cause I have to think I'm not there yet, but I have to think it's going to come back and haunt you when you are on your deathbed someday.
Well, I mean, they say at the end of your life, you only regret the things you didn't do, not the things you've done.
Well, I hope that's true. but that can be difficult too, because especially like my situation, right? We talked earlier about fly fishing. I really love the mountains and that's where I would love to live, but we live in San Diego. And so I keep dropping little hints every now and then, like, hey, let's move up to Lake Tahoe or Jackson, Wyoming or something. And you know, that's a pretty significant uprooting. So for me, I love the occasional trip because it kind of scratches that itch. But, you know, I think there will always be that longing. And so in the grand scheme of things, I have to temper it with, this is where our family has chosen to settle down. And that's, you know, got to make the most of that too.
Well, yeah, compromise definitely factors into that, of mm-hmm. course. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, life is too short not to at least have goals and dreams. And if you want to live in Wyoming at some point, then put on the, maybe when the kids are grown, you guys will retire there, you know?
Well, I have told my wife that I'm probably not going to win husband of the year for this, but when we first moved back to San Diego, because we'd lived here before, our youngest, I think, was in fifth grade or something. And I said, hey, look, because the schools were a big draw for coming here. I said, look, I'll live here for 8 years. After that, I'm moving to the mountains. I hope you come with me. I think she understood the implied joke. But we have talked about if we continue to, and this is going to be our best decade for earning. So if we can afford to do it, we'd love to get a cabin or, you know, share something with another family, let's say somewhere in one of those locations I already mentioned where we can get away.
Maybe you'll end up flying a helicopter in Wyoming for somebody or something.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any helicopter time, so probably not, but you know, just to be able to get up to some place where there's skiing and fishing and lakes and mountains and trees and all that's where I think I'm meant to be.
Well, Vincent, before we do the last thing on the show, I have to tell you that, you know, the name of my podcast, Memories of a Moonbird, that I don't know if you're aware, but a moonbird is a real bird. It's a red knot. And it was nicknamed a moonbird because its migration pattern is so long that in its lifetime, it flies from the south of Patagonia all the way up to the Arctic. And it does this every year.
Crazy.
It flies so many miles that it can go to the moon and back. And so they nicknamed it Moonbird.
Ah.
And so I've traveled a great deal in my life. And at some point, Jolene and I were talking and I was explained to her how much I've traveled. And she looked at me and she said, you're a moonbird. And so I've had a few people on the show who have flown or traveled so many miles in their life that they are also moonbirds. And I want to tell you that you, sir, are also a moonbird with the number of miles you have flown.
All right. So, well, that is an honor I will wear proudly, Daniel. Thank you very much.
There you go. Well, the last thing we do on the show is a little game I have called 299 Philosophical and Life Questions with Moonbird. I have this list of fun philosophical life questions, 299 of them, but you get to pick two at random and you give me your two favorite numbers and I'll read you those two questions.
Well, let's go with 18 since that's not only the airplane I flew, but the day of my birth. And then how about, I was going to go 213.
But yeah, 213. Perfect. Okay. Number 18, do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
Both. I don't think you have to be one or the other. Depends on the setting. I used to be more introverted when I went by my first name. Since I've begun going by my middle name, Vincent, I've actually become less introverted and more outgoing. If depending on the type of setting, the party, the type of people there, I might sort of hide in the corner or I might work the crowd. So I think I've got I don't think it's binary. I think I can be both.
That's cool. Number 213, could you live without the internet?
Oh, yeah. Easily. It's called the Trout River. Now, the podcast would go away and some people might be disappointed. But, you know, at some point on that note, you know, I'll turn 51 later this year. So this is a young person's activity. And the longer I'm away from it, as far as my recency goes, the less relevant I will be. So at some point, we'll have to talk about a succession plan for the Fighter Podcast. But until then, yeah, I do need the internet for as I like to call them, the drug addicts I've created, because people start listening to the show and they need a hit. And I give them a fix every 10 days.
That's awesome. Vincent Aiello, I can't thank you enough for being here. You are so cool. And thank you for talking all things fighter jets and, of course, real life.
Well, you're welcome, Daniel. Thank you for having me. This has been quite therapeutic, actually. So I appreciate and applaud what you're doing for people out there, even if it's one by one.
Oh, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. And friends and listeners, if you'd like to check out Vincent's amazing podcast, go to any major podcast platform and check out the Fighter Pilot Podcast or visit fighterpilotpodcast.com. And while you're out there surfing the web, why don't you head on over to patreon.com/moonbird and show your support for this show so we can keep making cool episodes like this one. And if you'd like some more Moonbird in your life, and hey, who wouldn't? Why don't you fly yourself on over to memoriesofamoonbird.com or visit me on social media at Memories of a Moonbird. Stay safe.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.